It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the technology industry is hitting a rare financial decline. We'll find out what might be causing it, what impact it could have, and whether another bubble is bursting. Now, there's a major shortage of baby formula in the U.S. right now. About 40% of baby formula just isn't on the shelves. The shortage was triggered by the closure of a plant in Michigan earlier this year. But why would the closure of one plant cause such a big shortage in the first place? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your life right now? Are you a parent in need of baby formula? Has the shortage impacted you, or have you been able to find it in store on store shelves? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Colin Lodewyk is a writing fellow at Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy. Colin, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, of course. Thank you for having me on.
Well, the center of this story, this plant in Michigan, an Abbott Nutrition plant, had to pull a product connected to infant deaths because of contamination. Remind us what was going on there.
Yeah, so to understand what's happening, you kind of have to go back to fall of last year. Between September 2021 and February 2022, there were reports of 4 illnesses, like you said, and 2 deaths in infants that were linked to baby formula produced at this single plant owned by Abbott in Sturgis, Michigan, and a bacteria called Chronobacter sakazaki. In response to those reports, the company voluntarily recalled its products on February 17th and began its own investigation into the potential contamination. In line with its own investigation, the FDA also had its own investigation, which it started on January 31st, but that didn't complete until March 16th. So Chronobacter is a pretty common bacteria, and Abbott found it during its investigation, later said that using genomic sequencing, the bacteria that it found did not correspond to the strain that was linked to those infant deaths and illnesses. The FDA, through their investigation, found other compliance issues that kind of go beyond the specific issue with this bacteria, including workers at the plant not wearing proper protective gear, things like that. So as a result, the plant is still shut down. And yeah, that's kind of where things are right now and what has happened.
So why is the closure of one plant having such a big impact overall? You might think, well, it's just one factory.
Yeah, of course. So the thing is, baby formula is an extremely, extremely tightly regulated industry. Like in terms of the Food and Drug Administration, it sort of falls more on the drug side just because there are so many specific things that have to go into formula. And as a result, the companies that have the most resources have been able to dominate the industry for years. The most recent numbers that I have from 2011, I believe, from a USDA report said that Abbott had a 43% share of the market. Little has changed since then. Another factor contributing is the fact that these major manufacturers are able to enter into exclusive contracts with the USDA's Supplemental Nutrition Program for Low-Income Families. Its nickname is WIC. And when it has a contract with WIC, it basically, you know, contributes or provides baby formula for low-income families in an entire state. Based on numbers that I have, Abbott provides baby formula for approximately half of WIC participants.
Now, we've got this shortage. You talked to some people in your reporting and asked your readers to share stories. What kind of things did you hear from people as they try to scramble to find formula?
Yeah, so people across the country are, you know, feeling the shortage, feeling very desperate. Something that I've been hearing again and again is how people are spending hours and days driving between different locations trying to find any formula on the shelves. A lot of the times parents rely on a, you know, specific type of formula that works best for their child. And then when they are not able to find that specific formula, they are kind of are reticently switching to other formulas that maybe might be, maybe their children don't respond to as well. I've also heard a lot from grandparents who are, you know, because their children maybe are working parents, don't have the time to be going store to store. So they're the ones kind of taking up the extra effort along with, you know, other family members or friends. I've also, you know, been hearing reports of people using alternative formulas, homemade formulas, you know, that is widely recommended to not happen. You know, pediatricians across the country say do not use homemade formula, but when people are being pushed to sort of desperate measures, that's like, you know, one kind of avenue that it seems like people turn to. And then when people are not able to access formula at all, there are also reports that they're, you know, watering down formula, just, you know, stretch the last can a couple more days. So, you know, I think a lot of people are kind of at their wits' end with what's going on.
In just a few minutes, we'll hear from a Wisconsin nutritionist with recommendations on what to do and not to do, including a couple of things that Colin mentioned readers were doing. Colin Lodewyk is with us from Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy, looking at this baby formula shortage around the United States, causes and possible solutions. And let's turn to that now. Colin, Abbott reached a deal with the FDA to reopen its plant. I'm guessing this doesn't mean that they're going to have product ready to hit the shelves tomorrow.
Yeah, of course. So that agreement actually still needs to be approved by a court in Michigan. And, you know, once it does, which could take a couple weeks, it'll take an additional 6 to 8 weeks before Abbott products actually end up on store shelves.
So that's that plant. Looking around the country, the other companies, the other plants that make infant baby formula, are they able to spin their production up to help make up some of the shortfall?
Yes, the FDA has reported that it's been, you know, in talks with all these other major players, including Nestle and Mead Johnson, in order to ratchet up their own production of formula.
And then how about importing formula from other countries?
I believe on Monday, the Biden administration announced that it would start to, you know, the FDA has very strict requirements for importing formula into the United States, but on Monday, Biden announced that he would ease some of those requirements to make it easier for foreign product to get into the U.S.
And are people talking
I also want to say that Abbott has said that it is attempting to also import product from its facility in Ireland, you know, to help mitigate the crisis.
Now, are people these are shorter term solutions. Are people talking about changes that need to be made so in future, if there's a contamination at one plant, it doesn't create a crisis like this?
You know, that's an interesting question. I actually haven't really been seeing any solutions for what might happen going forward besides, you know, more stringent requirements at, you know, different plants when they detect potential contamination, things like that. But in terms of, you know, breaking up monopolies or making it easier for competitors to get into the market, it seems like that is a conversation that's more difficult to have and probably, you know, further off in the future.
And Colin, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next on this story?
I am, you know, talking with as many parents as I can. I have, I believe, you know, 3 calls set up today with mothers who, you know, can't get formula still. I think I am interested to see if, you know, Abbott says that it'll take 6 to 8 weeks to get formula back on store shelves. I'm wondering if things will get a lot worse until then, or if maybe the other efforts that the FDA, the government, and Abbott are taking will start lessening the crisis over the next couple of weeks.
Colin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Colin Lodewyk is a writing fellow at Fortune, where he reports on work and the economy. He talked to us about the ongoing baby formula shortage, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Coming up, we're going to hear from a Wisconsin pediatric dietitian. We want to hear from you if you use this formula, if you are able to find it. If you are, great. We'd love to hear about that things are going well for you. If you've had trouble, if you've had to switch brands or switch stores to be able to find it, what are you seeing out there? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page or email us ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk about a baby formula shortage. We're going to get some advice from a Wisconsin dietitian now. Still time to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Parents and grandparents, what are you seeing out there if you rely on this formula? Are you finding it on store shelves easily, switching brands, or just flat out having trouble finding a source? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you work with infants as a pediatrician in healthcare or other services, what are you hearing from your patients, your clients? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Hey, if you work at a store that sells this stuff, Are the shelves empty or you got a pretty good supply? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Camilla Martin is a pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health. Camilla, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
I want to start with something we just heard from Colin, who's been reporting on this. Some of the parents he's talked to have said they're watering down the formula, diluting it more. I understand that's not a great solution. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. So the issue with watering down formula is because us as adults, our bodies have the ability to process nutrients and things that come in really different ways. We have a much more advanced just body as a whole and gut. So it's the kidneys that filter water. And if we're diluting down formula, it's making it more concentrated with water. And for an infant, their kidneys are not actually able to process that. So it can be quite dangerous and has resulted in hospitalizations and even infant deaths. So that's why we strongly encourage not watering down formula if a family is able to do that.
And then Colin also mentioned you heard for people looking for online recipes for formula. What are the problems we run into there?
So many of these recipes are coming from the 50s, 60s, before we had the FDA's tightly regulated system that Colin had mentioned. So these recipes, similar to watering down formula, can be very dangerous. Our body has the ability to break down different nutrients as they come in. For us as adults, if we have a day where we don't eat as well as maybe we should have, our body's still able to process that in a safe way. But for an infant, their body isn't able to break things down. So proteins that it's not able to break down can be left undigested in the gut and can be quite dangerous and can lead to things like GI bleeds or malabsorption or just other issues that are really dangerous for infants.
Okay, those are a couple things to avoid. Let's talk about things that we can do now. A lot of brands are out of stock, but there might be other brands. How big a deal is it in most cases for parents of infants to switch to a brand that maybe they haven't been used to using?
I'm really glad you brought this up because as Colin has mentioned, this has been, these supply issues have been something that we've been dealing with in our pediatric specialty clinics for a good 6 months now. So we're handling these questions every day. Each formula company has different levels of different types of formula. A lot of them will use language that makes it seem like one is maybe better than the other. And some may be better tolerated for one child versus another. However, many formulas will have an alternative to a formula that a family is not able to find. So it is perfectly safe, and it is within that FDA tightly regulated system. So it's perfectly safe to switch from one brand of formula to another. If an infant or child is particularly sensitive, occasionally we'll recommend to our families that they make a smaller batch of formula according to the directions on the can. It is okay to mix them to provide a more gradual transition. Otherwise, if a baby is fed from a bottle, we've had them switch every other feed. However, if they don't have some of that previously well-tolerated formula, it is okay to switch directly from one brand to another. That is perfectly safe and will be a much better option than watering down formula and can also make formula much more accessible. I'm working with families, and Colin mentioned stories for some of the individuals he's interviewing, for them having to drive hours to different stores to find a new formula. That can be really, really challenging to families that have difficulty accessing safe, reliable transportation with the rising cost of gas prices. So switching to an alternative brand can be perfectly safe and can make some of that stress a bit relieved to find something that's closer by.
Now, for patients, for parents who can't find a formula for their kids and, you know, maybe not don't have the wherewithal or, you know, their parents, the time to drive all over the county looking for formula, what kind of options out there? What kind of resources might be out there for them to get at least a temporary holdover batch?
So first, I would recommend finding an alternative brand that might be available at their local store. Each formula company uses slightly different language to differentiate what's standard versus sensitive versus comfort, soothe, or gentle. If they do feel comfortable navigating that language on their own, it is okay to switch to any other standard formula if that's what their infant or child was on previously. So that can be the easiest and can avoid some of that extra driving around. If a family has questions on that, I recommend that they reach out to their primary physician's office to help differentiate which one might be best for their infant, especially if they've had issues tolerating different types before. Otherwise, if they're working in like a pediatric specialty clinic with access to a registered dietitian, this is kind of the bread and butter of a lot of the things that we do. So we can provide an alternative. If they aren't able to find something in the stores, we're recommending that families look to an online major retailer, like any of the major companies directly through their own website can be a good first option. Through like a certified Amazon retailer can be another option. Major stores like the Targets, the Walmarts, the Walgreens, the CVSs, good on the list. You can oftentimes purchase things online. So we would recommend starting there. If they're still not having luck with that, then we'd recommend utilizing their support system. Social media groups can be a great resource. I've heard of families who are who have the time and ability to go from store to store and are taking videos of what's in different stores. So there might be information on where to find information there or to find formula there. Because of the extra media attention, it's been really helpful that more people are talking about it. So reaching out to caregivers of infants and children that are dependent on formulas, they might be able to find something at a store near them before the parent is having to drive from place to place. I would caution families against purchasing formula if it's not from an authorized retailer. If it's from a social media group or a Craigslist or from like a foreign website, we don't have the regulations like we would over the major retailers. So there's no way to guarantee that it's not expired or recalled or was held at a temperature that could make it go bad. Also, if that formula is impacted by a recall in the future. If it's through a major retailer, lots of times families can get a reimbursement for that. You can't do that if it's from a family member or support system. So that can be a good resource, but we're definitely cautioning our families to make sure that it's from a safe source.
We're talking to Camilla Martin, pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health, looking at a shortage of formula for infants around the country and some advice. Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Fran is with us in La Crosse. Fran, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious because I haven't heard this discussed before on the program tonight. Just wondering about women who are able to breastfeed and if this shortage might encourage those who are able to that haven't before to do so. It's free. It's accessible for those women who can breastfeed. And I don't want to shame those who do use formula because, of course, for medical reasons and other reasons, there are women who just aren't able to breastfeed and do need to rely on formula. But I'm just wondering if your guest could comment on that.
Fran, thanks for the call. Camilla?
Yeah, I'm really glad this topic came up because that's a big part of my role as well. We've been really focusing on formula. But as a certified lactation specialist working with families increasing or increasing their ability to breastfeed is another big piece of what I do. Breast milk is an excellent source of nutrition. It's really kind of the gold standard for infants. So if a family is able to provide their infant breast milk, we would absolutely encourage that. And there's lots of different lactation resources around the community within a family's healthcare system. Generally, there will be a breastfeeding specialist available there. There's oftentimes breastfeeding specialists available through a local WIC office, the Women, Infants, Children program that Colin had mentioned, which as a side note is also a great resource for good information on alternative formula and obtaining formula that I didn't mention before. There's other community-based organizations like La Leche that will have presence in most communities. There's different organizations that you might be able to find in your local area. In Dane County, we have a wonderful resource in the African American Breastfeeding Alliance that partners with the Harambe Village Doulas, Roots for Change that partners with Centro Hispano. There's a clinic called Today, Not Tomorrow. So there's quite a few breastfeeding resources that are available. And if a family is struggling to provide enough breast milk, they're having issues with it being painful, supply is an issue, we would definitely encourage them to reach out to those resources to help make that a little bit easier and more feasible. However, unfortunately, this is not always something that's possible for families to provide due to, as the caller mentioned, medical issues, issues with not enough paid family leave, with not being provided sufficient breaks. So there are issues that can interfere with that. So that's when formula can be a good backup. And that's when we get into all of these alternatives that we've been discussing.
Fran, thanks for the call. Aaron joins us now in Milwaukee. Aaron, hi.
Hi. I think this is related to the last caller's question, but I was just curious what awareness and communication is going on with people giving birth right now at hospitals or birthing centers? You know, because if people are on the fence of, am I going to try the breastfeeding route? Am I going formula? Knowing that there's a shortage, I think, can inform people's decision. And so I was just wondering what kind of communication and awareness is being done with people giving birth or are pregnant right now.
Aaron, thanks for the call. Camilla?
That's a great question. So that's outside of the area that I currently work in. However, most local birthing centers will have their own breastfeeding class. That could be maybe partnered with a childbirth class or could be on its own. Quite a few of those organizations that I mentioned that can provide lactation support after an infant is born will also have classes or resources for a family to get informed on how to go about breastfeeding their infant. So I would encourage them to utilize those resources. Again, the WIC program is a really excellent resource for breastfeeding information from breastfeeding specialists, as well as a variety of different handouts and pamphlets and information to help a family prepare.
Thanks for that call. And Camilla, thank you so much for sharing the advice and resources with us today.
Absolutely.
Camilla Martin is a pediatric registered dietitian at UW Health. She told us about resources for parents amid the major baby formula shortage going on right now. I'll just say, as an adoptive parent of twins back in the day, we relied pretty heavily on formula. So my thoughts are with you if you're trying to deal with this. Good luck to you. Hope you can find what you need out there. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, the pesticide DDT was sold as a miracle weapon against mosquitoes, but it caused massive ecological damage, driving bald eagles and other bird species to the brink of extinction. Look at the rise, fall, and possible return of DDT with the author of the new book, How to Sell a Poison. And as always, you can join in with your questions and your thoughts. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I had a meal with sweet potato the other day, which I like, but the question came up, what's the difference between a sweet potato and yam? Is there a difference? Are they the same thing? The real answer, they are not the same thing. The answer in stores, yeah, sometimes they are. I looked this up on Epicurious and some other cooking sites. Here's the quick deal. Sweet potatoes and yams, they are different things. They're not even closely related. Sweet potatoes in the morning glory family, yams are closer to palms and grasses. Quick way to tell them apart, sweet potatoes, smooth-skinned, generally reddish-brown, they taste, you know, sweet. Yams, rougher-skinned, they look like tree bark, they're starchier. But at some point in American history, people started calling sweet potatoes yams. And the FDA, they don't care what you call them. So grocery stores often label their sweet potatoes as yams. So no wonder I'm confused. I am what I am. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Kohl's has avoided another takeover attempt from activist investors on Wall Street. A Wisconsin business writer tells us what happened and why she thinks the takeover plan would have been bad for the store and maybe employees and customers, too. Now, recent declines in the stock market are being led, in some cases, by technology companies. Even some big names like Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, and Google have dropped significantly since the start of the year. A lot of those companies continued to thrive through the pandemic as the rest of the economy struggled. That seems to be coming to an end. The drop-off has been compared to the dot-com bubble that burst in the early 2000s. It's a different financial world now. Aaron Griffith is a reporter for the New York Times who covers technology startups and venture capital. Aaron, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, between the time we called you to come on and now, today happened a big drop in the stock market overall. Like what? I assume the technology stocks are part of this?
Yeah, I mean, they have sort of been on the bleeding edge of this sell-off, you know, as investors rotate out of high growth and high risk stocks into, you know, sort of more reliable stocks that maybe are, you know, kind of blue chip that have paid dividends and that have sort of slow and steady growth, because I think they're sort of realizing that the crazy growth that a lot of tech companies saw in the pandemic is certainly slowing way down. And they're also seeing that there's a lot of uncertainty out there between all of the macro factors that I'm sure we'll get into.
You wrote a piece recently looking at years of people saying, yeah, we're in a technology stock bubble and it's going to burst any day now. And it doesn't burst. It keeps going on and on. Is it finally happening?
You know, it's been about like 12 to 15 years of just a bull market, you know, and everyone has these scars from the dot-com bubble in 2000 when that burst, and is kind of just anticipating and looking for signs of that happening again. And so every time things got a little bit overheated over the last decade, you know, everyone is very quick to say, oh no, it's the bubble again. Everyone get ready. This is the big one, because they have those memories of how painful that was when the bubble burst in 2000. And it just hasn't happened, you know. We've had low interest rates for over a decade now, basically since the financial crisis of 2008. And that has pushed investors to continue to take more and more risks. And so that brings them, you know, into the high growth and high risk tech startup category. And they've been, you know, fueling huge growth in that category for a long time. And investors have reaped the profits of that. I mean, you know, Facebook becoming a $1 trillion company that, like, you know, was just a startup over a decade ago. And so you've seen that huge value can be created out of these companies, but there is that risk. And so a lot of people are, you know, eager and very willing to raise the flags, even though it just seemed to keep going up over and over and over. This time could be different. And that's what everyone's kind of looking and waiting to see. There's just a lot of macro factors, inflation, the interest rates going up for the first time in a very long time, the war in Russia and in the Ukraine, and the uncertainty that has created, the continued supply chain disruptions. There's a lot of uncertainty out there. And so investors are starting to kind of pull back the risk that they've been taking for such a long time.
I think there's a perception for like Silicon Valley type startups that I could come up with, you know, I've invented this web-enabled toothpaste, and there's going to be a venture capitalist who will just shower money at me, even if it's a stupid idea and I won't make any money doing it ever. I mean, how close to reality is that perception?
I mean, I would say for the last 2 years, it's been a lot closer than ever before. I mean, the pandemic really showed investors that there's huge opportunities. It's speeding up accelerating the adoption of new technology. A lot of people talked about how, you know, it was 5 years of tech adoption that was crammed into 6 months when we all went into lockdown in early 2020. And that was this huge opportunity. And so, you know, people were just showering money on startups, some of them very, you know, sort of half-baked. And so I did feel like a kind of out of control frenzy for a little while there. And I think now we're seeing that come back down to earth, and it's going to be painful for some startups. And, you know, others will figure out how to cut costs and, you know, maybe slow their hiring and return to a sort of a more reasonable growth. And they'll weather this and be stronger on the other side. But yeah, it did really feel like things got kind of frenzied and out of control for the last at least year and a half.
Let's look at something like Amazon, where it was already big and huge. And then with the pandemic, all these people were learning, even if they hadn't ordered online before, learning to become Amazon customers. Are people just going back to stores now? Or are we just kind of going back to earth in that way?
It's true. I mean, I guess part of it is like the gains have been locked in to some extent for some of these companies because behaviors have changed. But at the same time, I think a lot of people dumped money into tech thinking this is the new reality, this is the future, we're going to be on Zoom forever. And, you know, after a little while, everyone kind of realized, oh, I'm tired of that. I want to go back to in-person stuff. Or maybe I like picking out my own groceries and I'll order online occasionally, or I don't want to pay these high fees to order takeout all the time. I'm just going to go to the restaurant now that it's open again. So I think, you know, investors maybe got a little ahead of themselves in baking in future growth for some of these new behaviors that we adopted during the pandemic. And at the same time, I mean, the companies are still growing and behaviors had changed, but maybe just not to the extent that the stock prices reflected.
Is the culture changing now? If I show up with my pitch for my e-toothpaste, am I going to get more doors slammed in my face today than I would have a year ago?
You know, venture capitalists are sounding the alarm on Twitter. I mean, every day there's news of another startup that's doing layoffs or that's struggling to raise funding, and the VCs are out there saying, oh no, the sky is falling. And it's kind of funny because they were also the same ones that were kind of pumping up the hype machine and the investment frenzy that we saw over the last couple of years. But that has changed faster than I've probably ever seen it in the last decade. You know, the investors have become very, very cautious, and it's become pretty hard for founders to raise money if they don't have something to show for it, or they can't show, you know, a path to actually turning a profit. And certainly the valuations that had gotten really, really frothy and, you know, away from the fundamentals of what the business can actually deliver have come down to earth. And so a lot of companies are facing a reality check on that front too.
How connected is what's going on with cryptocurrencies right now? There's a lot of talk, a lot of hype about them being great vehicles during an uncertain economy, during times of high inflation. Here we are. They've done poorly lately, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, that's been an interesting thing because that has been the selling point. Like, buying Bitcoin is a hedge against inflation, but in fact, in an inflationary time, Bitcoin's going down now. So yeah, it is kind of a little bit of a head scratcher on that message. And I think part of that is that, you know, it is a risky investment. And like I said, people are cycling out of risk and they see their money falling in Bitcoin and they're like, crap, I don't want to lose any more. And so the fear kind of creates more fear. And so, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how that sort of plays out. And I would say more broadly in the crypto world, I mean, a lot of these projects were very fly by night, and we saw a massive collapse last week with one of them called Luna that was supposed to be tied to a stable coin. And so I think people are starting to sort of question, you know, okay, how exposed do I want to be to this if some of these projects go all the way to zero? And you know, the crypto industry, unlike the tech industry, is still relatively young. And so there's a lot of noise in there. And, you know, it's going to be really rocky, I think, in that category.
Apart from sorting through what happened today on the stock market, Aaron, what are you watching for next with technology stocks?
You know, the IPO market is pretty much closed right now. And we did see one of the biggest, most valuable startups, announced in maybe last week that it was planning to try to go public. And so I'll be really curious to see if tech startups start trying to test the market. And if a company is able to go public in this market, that means that investors might be willing to try, you know, testing out, taking on a little risk, backing a high growth company again. Right now, the market's pretty much closed. So that's what I'll be looking for to see, you know, if suddenly the investors start getting greedy again, because, you know, like Warren Buffett and many investors say, you know, the time to buy is when everyone's being fearful. And so if that changes quickly, then, you know, that could mean that this downturn that we're seeing right now won't last that long. And it'll be just like the ones that we've seen, the little mini blips that we've seen over the last decade, where it's a moment or a few months of fear and then things just come zooming right back. Right now, the mood is quite grim out there, and it seems like people are really settling in for a longer downturn. But if companies start going public again and there's a new demand for risk, then, you know, that could change.
Aaron, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's Aaron Griffith with the New York Times with us today to look at why tech company stocks are falling and how the industry is responding. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a story about foraging for a Wisconsin delicacy.
Morel mushrooms are a coveted treat in Wisconsin every spring, but the right conditions for finding them can be as finicky and moody as the state's springtime weather. Yet the result is well worth the effort. Writer Mark Griffin takes you on a journey to find that elusive morel mushroom.
Welcome to Wisconsin's premier morel hunting expedition. Is this your first time hunting with us? Wonderful. You're sure to find success, just like I have exactly twice since 2010. That's when I began hunting these very woods myself. Yep, exactly twice. And no, I have not had any training whatsoever, but that's what the internet is for, right? There's a massive tract of wilderness in front of us, hundreds of acres of trees, grasses, prairie, swamps, and streams. Somewhere over this box of green lie our golden treasures, the morel mushrooms, poking their obscene little noggins out from under the underbrush. And if we search long enough for them, We'll find those elusive fleshy brains. But neither of us have all day, so out of this necessity, we'll refine our search. Under a log, next to a fallen oak tree, a shady spot on a steeper grade where, a few years ago, I had some luck myself. Pinpointing the few choicest spots is what you're paying me good money for. And yet, you will note in the contract you sign that my flagrantly minimal morel hunting expertise does not guarantee success. But what if we discover nothing? Then we have failed, and me spectacularly so, as your guide and leader. Yet, in that process, we will have achieved something else. We will become accustomed to zooming in on the landscapes in front of us, combing the painted underbrush and thorny thickets for those elusive spongy fungi. We may find the perfect fallen ash to rest. Slowly, everything begins to shrink. The tiny becomes large. The large fuzzes out of focus. That buckthorn, unavoided, scrapes your shin, but refrains its sting. The fly landing on your hat is left unswatted to catch a warm break. In the light breeze, the leaves on the farthest branch of that aspen perform the dance they were meant to do on this earth, the shiver and quake. We start to notice something different in the afternoon light as well. Then we begin to empathize with the still undiscovered morel mushrooms of the day. They're enjoying a cloak of invisibility just over that hill, I'm sure, beyond the map, just out of reach. Let them go from our expectations. Let go of the need to do and finish and accomplish this morel hunting task that, let's be clear, could absolutely be completed with the right expertise and luck, neither of which you enjoy today. Do we have any other choice? An oak savanna, long and familiar, breathes a simple sigh. Now's the time in our adventure where I cut you loose for a few minutes to search on your own and... Oh, what's that? You found some? Already? Huh. Well, I guess we'll just call it beginner's luck, won't we? So you did find what you were looking for today, the elusive morel mushroom. Are you ready to go home now?
Writer Mark Griffin brought us that story about hunting for morel mushrooms. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
Coming up, a Wisconsin business writer joins the show to talk about the latest on Kohl's fight with some Wall Street investors. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Kohl's has been a target of some Wall Street investors who say the company isn't generating enough value for its shareholders. Last week, the Menominee Falls retailer avoided another takeover attempt. In a recent column from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, our guest says the Wall Street investors looking to shake up Kohl's are using an old, tired, and greedy strategy. Kathleen Gallagher is executive director of the Five Lakes Institute, which promotes innovation and entrepreneurship in the Great Lakes region. She won a Pulitzer Prize during her time as a business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She writes a regular column there now. Kathleen, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. Nice to be back.
Remind us what sparked this takeover attempt.
Well, you said it, greed. a New York firm that does this a lot, they love to go after retailers, because particularly retailers who have a lot of land, you know, stores that they own. They like to go after them. And one of the things they like to do, I don't want to get too complicated on you, but what they like to do is use the real estate that these retailers have to back their acquisition, you know, as collateral. For loans they get to acquire the retailer. So it's like they're using the retailer's real estate to make the acquisition, if that makes sense.
Sure. And then is this a thing where, you know, maybe they make money in the short run, but it's not that healthy for the store in the long run? I remember reading something similar about, I think, Toys R Us.
Well, or Sears. You know, Sears is the big example where, you know, this guy came in, started running Sears, and basically used all the real estate to borrow money and it turned into not Sears anymore, right?
So what has the current leadership of Kohl's said about its long-term viability in a market that can be tough for big retail stores?
Well, they're really locked on to a new strategy. You know, they have this CEO, Michelle Gass, who's been there for a couple of years, and she's got a strategy that she keeps pushing. The big piece of the strategy right now that people have probably seen in the stores is this partnership with Sephora. And I, from what I can see in my Kohl's store, you know, they move the jewelry and put right front and center the cosmetics area run by, you know, that is a partnership with Sephora. And I think cosmetics probably have higher margins. So, you know, she's arguing that's the thing that's going to help Kohl's come out of this. There are other parts to it, like a focus on athletic wear, which is popular right now, that kind of stuff. So.
Now, Kohl's is a national chain, but of course, it's based in Wisconsin, big employer here in Wisconsin. So some people are listening and thinking, what does this mean for my job? What does fending off this takeover attempt mean for people who, you know, actually work for Kohl's?
Well, there are two kinds of jobs, right? There are the people who work at a Kohl's store, and, you know, that would depend on, well, let me back up. There are, I assume, still five offers for Kohl's. I mean, what happened is these people went at Kohl's, this activist firm in New York, and everybody said, oh, let's get in on this. You know, we could make an offer. We can do something with it. So there are a bunch of offers for Kohl's. And so it would depend upon who bought them and, you know, whether they were viewing it as a real estate play or a retail, enhancing the retail brand, right? So for the people who work in the stores, a lot would depend on what kind of acquirer got hold of the company. If that happened, Kohl's seems to have fended it off. The real jobs that I think we're talking about are at the headquarters. You know, if someone bought Kohl's, it's pretty unlikely that all those headquarters jobs would stay in the Milwaukee area.
Yeah, there was this attempt. The current management fended it off. But as you say, there are other offers on the table. Are they going to just be here next week, next month, and so on as different groups try to make offers or do takeovers?
Well, the argument I'm making in this column is that because the economy is changing so fast, it's changing these types of offers. You know, for the last 20 years, with low interest rates and high real estate values, it's made sense to make these kind of offers because you can go after the real estate, you can finance it with low interest rates. I'm arguing, you know, interest rates are obviously going up. When interest rates go up, real estate values go down. I'm arguing this kind of offer isn't going to work anymore. So my argument is it won't work. There's an analyst at Morningstar, David Schwartz, who I talked to for this column, and he was just quoted the other day in a Journal Sentinel article about what's going to happen next. He thinks, you know, they're going to keep coming at Kohl's. Kohl's is going to have to fight it off. Kohl's should sell now. You know, he feels very differently than I do. I just think the economy is going to help Kohl's in the long run.
During especially the earliest days of the pandemic, stores weren't able to open even when they were. People might have been shy about going into them. That, as we were just hearing in our previous interview, helped Amazon for a while. Is there a sense, Kathleen, that, you know, things are back to normal-ish? People are happy to go back and shop in stores like Kohl's?
Well, certainly they have more traffic with the pandemic not being as severe. The argument I'm making in this column is that, you know, I think Amazon may have peaked. You know, when you think about it, Amazon depends on cheap credit, you know, cheap, low interest rates, cheap energy to move stuff around and cheap labor. And all of those things are changing, you know, so that's going to change Amazon. Is it going to make sense to have the delivery person who doesn't want to work for the pay that they can get from Amazon delivering a product using gas to get it there? You know, I don't know. It's the pandemic plus this changing economic environment, I'm arguing.
Now, this fight isn't over. As you say, more offers still on the table. What are you watching for next in the story of Kohl's?
I mean, I'm kind of watching the economy, right? And the other points I made in the column is that, you know, these activist investors are saying, They're so dumb. They're not doing anything with their real estate. They've got all these stores and, you know, they could be, it's called a sale leaseback. They could be selling the real estate and leasing the property to run their stores, which I think Cole's argument is, well, if we do that next time we hit a downturn, we have these big rent payments that we don't have now, and then we're in trouble, you know, which if you're worried about the short term, you don't care about. One of the arguments I'm making in the column is John Schlifsky, who's the CEO of Northwestern Mutual, is on Cole's board. This is a big insurance company that has, you know, a lot of money that it invests and understands real estate. I'm kind of guessing that he understands this. I just think going into what the new economic reality that we're headed for, that Kohl's has a real shot of surviving this. But like I said, this guy at Morningstar in Chicago, you know, he says there's going to be another proxy fight and they're going to have to sell.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Kathleen Gallagher, talking about her column in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about the future of Kohl's. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk to the author of a new book that argues our economic system needs to be reformed to be less reliant on the Federal Reserve and put more responsibility back on Congress. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.